Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. John Grisham was famously a courthouse lawyer himself nearly 30 years ago when he stumbled on the case that became his first novel, A Time to Kill. Since that book came out, he's been back again and again with mega bestsellers that have captivated masses of readers and often harshly critiqued the justice system in America. He's had a mafia-run law firm in The Firm, Supreme Court justices assassinated in The Pelican Brief, Ku Klux Klan bombings in The Chamber. His latest out today is The Racketeer. This hour on Point, John Grisham and the legal thriller. Joining me now from New York is John Grisham, author of 30 books with his latest. Many huge bestsellers, 275 million books in print. What a number. 8 film adaptations, 2 made into television shows. His newest thriller out today is The Racketeer. John Grisham, welcome.
Hi, Tom. Happy to be here.
Very nice to have you. What have you got cooking for us this time, John?
Well, we're in New York doing a little publicity for The Racketeer, trying to get it properly launched and off the ground and in bookstores and the usual round of promotion when a book comes out.
Tell us, you know it well after 30. Tell us about this story. What's between these covers?
Well, another juicy legal thriller, I hope, with some dead bodies and lawyers in trouble and all kinds of goings-on. Our hero starts off in prison. He's a young lawyer who has obviously found himself on the wrong end of the law, and he has 5 more years to serve. He thinks he's innocent. He thinks he should not be in prison. And he's got a real axe to grind with the federal government and the people who put him in prison. And against that backdrop, a federal judge is murdered. And our hero, who never met the judge, knows exactly who did it and why. And so he plans and schemes to barter this information to help the FBI solve this sensational crime. And off we go.
Is he a hero?
Well, yeah, you got to have a sympathetic hero to make any story work. To make any, I do. When I write a legal thriller, you've got to have a hero that the reader can really pull for. Very few of my heroes are, well, not perfect, but they're flawed characters. But it's often a challenge to take someone who has a number of flaws and to turn them into a hero that the reader is really rooting for.
Though it gets trickier and trickier as we go, your protagonist is an African American. Have you, and you narrate the story in large part through his perspective, through his eyes, in his voice. Have you done that before?
No, not as the protagonist. No. It's the first time I've used a black guy in the role as our main hero.
What was that like for you as a writer, as a white guy, as a Southerner? I don't know.
You know, I never thought about race. I didn't think of him as being black or white. I said, this story is not about race. It's about, a guy who screwed up and got disbarred and got thrown in prison. Again, he thinks he shouldn't be there.
Though you have him very aware of race as he thinks about his legal career, as he thinks he's in a small law firm in a small town, as he thinks about how even other African Americans didn't necessarily want to patronize a black law firm because they were afraid it might not have the same clout in court.
Correct. Sure. That's all fiction, by the way. I've never known a law firm like that. I've been told and heard stories over the years that in the early days, back in the 50s and 60s, that, you know, black lawyers in the Deep South, and this story takes place in Virginia, mm-hmm. A slave state, that black lawyers did have a hard time, getting credibility, getting fair hearings, getting clients, oftentimes their own people thought that they could, if they could afford a lawyer, they'd prefer to hire a white one because he probably knew more and had more pull, and that it was difficult for young black lawyers in the Deep South a long time ago to make a living.
When I read your books, I'm always finding myself asking, what is a genuine reflection of reality here, and what's John telling a good story? You bring lots in from the law, lots in from law enforcement and the justice system. You write at one point in here, a key figure goes into a witness security program, and you write about what that's like. Everybody's thought about this sometimes. You know, what is it like when the government whisks you away and gives you a new identity? And you say they're talking to him, and they say the U.S. Marshals give you security, safety, provide for that for your health, you get new identity with documentation, obviously, financial assistance for housing, living expenses, medical care. We'll find you a job, they tell him. Once you're up and running, we don't monitor your daily activities, but we're always close by if you need us. How much of that is the way it really works in witness protection programs, John?
That's pretty accurate. Depending on the witness, depending on the informant and how much he knows and what crime he helps him solve, the U.S. Marshals run witness protection. And listen, I've bought probably a half a dozen books from Amazon. Just go search your Kindle or whatever. Mm-hmm. You can find 20 books on witness protection written by people who've gone through it, written by former U.S. Marshals who run the program. So this is not classified material, but it is fascinating. And the U.S. Marshal Service they will tell you that they've never lost a witness. And they sometimes have to provide protection for not only the informant but the informant's family and not friends but family members because of the danger. But, it's fascinating to me how you can just disappear and create a new life in another town and maybe a pretty good life.
But in The Racketeer, that system looks anything but perfect. And I guess again and again in your thrillers and your novels, the justice system is a hugely imperfect undertaking. In this one, there's a lot of anger, rage at the feds. What is your sense? Is this just make good grist, or are we sitting on a judicial system that is as rough and tumble and often wrong as this book and many others of yours suggest?
I think the system works. Most of the time the system works, but there are enough flaws in it, there are enough inequalities in it to seriously question many aspects of our criminal justice system, and there would be – the changes would be easy and would be fair and probably save a whole lot of money. I serve on the board of the Innocence Project here in New York, and I've been on the board, I think, 5 or 6 years. And we're actively working to overturn wrongful convictions and get innocent people out of prison. The guilty people obviously didn't go to prison. They're still out there. Mm-hmm. And it is so frustrating because every wrongful conviction I've seen could have been prevented at some level if the police and prosecutors had played fairly. And I get frustrated with these cases because the trials are not fair. And they're able to convince juries of a person's guilt when, in fact, the person was not guilty. So I'm troubled by the system. In this book, I spent a lot of time talking about it's white collar crime, and we have so many people in prison today for crimes or non-crimes or technical violations of these vast federal regulations that just Congress just cranks out and cranks out. And a lot of prosecutors who can get fairly creative in finding ways to apply these new laws to whoever they want to go after. And we have a lot of nonviolent, smart people in prison serving long sentences. It's very easy to get a long federal sentence, 20 years or so. And the wreckage and ruined lives is astonishing.
What's driving?
On my soapbox.
I'll
get off.
What drives that? Is it, young hotshot prosecutors looking to make their name, their career? Is it – why on earth would the system want, quote unquote, people who didn't deserve it to go away?
Well, you've never heard a politician run for office promising lighter sentences and fewer people in prison. So it starts off with the people who make the laws and provide the funding for a penal system that incarcerates more people than any other civilized nation in the world. We just lock them up, throw away the key, whatever, make criminals out of them, and with little regard to what happens. I mean, it's all tough on crime, the war on crime. That's where and get started. And then once you have the funding for prisons and you have the funding for law enforcement and for agencies and for prosecutors, you know, the system just starts rolling. And there, and again, there's just so many laws, especially at the federal level nowadays, that you know, they can, if there's a big criminal investigation and some wrongdoing here, there, whatever, it doesn't take a lot to find some a violation or a potential violation. And you find yourself on the wrong end of an investigation, and they keep piling on the alleged statutes and that you've broken. And they can – they're brutal. They can bring in – you know, threaten to bring in members of your family or your friends or whatever. And, you know, it spirals out of control and you wake up in prison.
Your guy here is clever enough to outwit it. That must be one in a million or 2 million. I mean, how many people can wiggle their way through all that?
Not many. One of the fascinating thing about this book is the Rule 35, which is a real – rule that every federal inmate is well versed in, and it's to simplify it greatly. If you're in prison and you can help the FBI or any law enforcement agency solve a crime on the outside, you can barter that information and get yourself out of prison.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the master of the legal thriller, John Grisham, about his writing life, his life, American justice, and his latest thriller out today. It's called The Racketeer. Here's a little bit from a TV show that was on earlier this year. He was executive producer, posed as a sequel to Grisham's 91 novel, The Firm. The NBC series of the same name followed famed Grisham character, attorney Mitch McDear, 10 years later in the TV show. In this clip, it was on in February, off by the summer, but McDear, played by John Lucas, is wrongly accused of murdering his own client.
I can sit here all day, McDear.
You can't hold me without probable cause, and you know it.
That's true. So let's consider what I have. I have Martin Moxon. Just your average insurance VP, except he splattered into a Monet painting outside the Parkview Hotel.
He jumped off the balcony.
I'm not finished. I have witnesses who saw you run from the scene. Now, you seem like a decent guy, McDear. You wouldn't run from the scene of a suicide, would you?
Then if you were at the scene, you would know the door to that room had been kicked in. And if you were any kind of detective, you'd know that I'm not the one who did that.
Then who did?
I don't know. But I didn't want to stick around and find out.
From NBC's The Firm on earlier this year, John Grisham was executive producer. He joins us from New York. John, does that mean you were hands-on or not? Or do you have a role when they trot out a franchise of yours?
You know, I've been the executive producer a couple times on movies and TV shows, and I have no idea what that means. It means I do no work, I can promise you that. I'm not hands-on, and I don't get involved. With the TV show The Firm, I did spend some time with the creator, the showrunner, and read the scripts and offered a few comments about the scripts, and I thought it was very good television. But I know nothing about making movies or TV shows, and so I stay away from it.
Read to us a little bit from The Racketeer, your latest out today. There's a scene here where your guy Malcolm Bannister, he's in prison. It's in a very low-security facility. His father was a state policeman. He's the only one who really comes to visit him much, and they're talking about what the son may do when he, 5 years hence, finally gets out. At least that's what he's looking at that point. He's got a kind of a skeptical – he says he's going to go abroad, do all this stuff. His father's a little skeptical. Could you read for us, John?
Yeah, it's early in the book, I think first, second chapter. Mm-hmm. The narrator is Malcolm. Most of the story is told through the Malcolm Bannister, our hero. And he's talking to his father, and they – his father's a pretty tough guy. They don't always get along. His dad says, the grass is always greener, huh? Yes, Dad, when you're in prison, every place has greener grass. What am I supposed to do? Go back home? Maybe become an unlicensed paralegal doing research for some tiny firm that cannot afford me? Maybe I would become a bail bondsman. How about a private detective? There are not a lot of options. He's nodding along. We've had this conversation at least a dozen times. And you hate the government, he says. Oh, yeah, Dad, I hate the federal government, the FBI, the U.S. attorneys, the federal judges, the fools who run the prisons. There is so much of it I hate. I'm sitting here doing 10 years for a non-crime because a hotshot U.S. attorney needed to jack up his kill quota. And if the government can nail my ass for 10 years with no evidence, just think of all the possibilities now that I have the words convicted felon tattooed on my forehead. I'm out of here, Pop, just as soon as I can make the break. He's nodding and smiling. Sure, Mal.
From John Grisham's latest thriller out today, it's called The Racketeer. Rule 35 puts exactly that get out of jail in play. Rule 35, as you say, John, saying if you can help solve a significant crime from inside, you may soon find yourself on the outside. That's what he goes for.
Not quite as simple as I make it in the book. Mm-hmm. It's a little more complicated because you often have to wait and you have to testify against the person you've squealed on. But Rule 35, again, is very popular among federal inmates, and they know how to try to work it.
I would think that that would lead to an awful lot of BS. I mean, if you're in prison and the way out is to say that you've solved the crime, wouldn't it be awfully tempting? I mean, it must obviously be to make up a story. And we often hear this in court. He's only saying that to serve his own interests.
I can assure you there is a lot of BS in prison. These guys have a lot of time to scheme and scam and create stories. And yes, sir, there's a lot of big tales created in prison, a lot of creative people trying to figure out ways to get out and time to do so.
It gets pretty creative indeed in the John Grisham's latest. A lot of callers for you. Stanton, Virginia. Gary, you're on the air with John Grisham.
Hi, Tom. Great show.
Thanks.
Hi, Mr. Grisham. I have a quick question. I'll take my response off the air. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on the idea, and I don't know a whole lot about it, the validity of it, whatever, but the notion of the prison industrial complex and private people making money off of this, so it just becomes a cycle, and it's like, hey, guilty, not guilty, whatever, throw them in, we make cash off of it. But thank you. I'll take my response.
The business of imprisonment. John?
Yeah, you know, it's a great issue, and I'm already doing research for a future book. One of these days I want to write about the prison system and how we do operate it, how it works and it doesn't work. But, you know, the notion of making money for profit off prisons I think is ridiculous. And also the sentencing disparities between people charged with the same crimes or convicted of the same crimes, how they vary from state to state, jurisdiction to jurisdiction, and by race and class. It's a national disgrace the way we run that part of our system. So yeah, I hope there's a big thick legal thriller somewhere in the works, but it's very much on my short list of topics to explore fairly soon.
Do you think our huge national deficit that we always hear about and the trouble states are having paying their bills, and I mean we've even seen California, you know, herding inmates out of prisons because they can't afford to keep them in. Do you think that will eventually change that huge prison complex and population? The cost of it.
I think yes. Yes, I think the cost of it will someday have an impact. When you put a guy in prison for a long time, you not only, you know, you have to feed him and all that, take care of him, you have to provide for his health care. We have an aging prison population, and it's about to bankrupt a bunch of our states. And so this, you know, 30 years into the war on crime, we've all gotten tough on crime. We've all these long sentences, you know, three strikes, you're out, throw away the key, lock them up, all this tough talk, you know. Now we're paying for it.
Let's go to Kenneth in Nashville, Tennessee. Kenneth, you're on with John Grisham.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to say to John that, I've read all of your books, every last one of them, but I saved The Innocent Man for last because, I'm reading it now. I'm halfway through. It is so very, very painful to read. Usually I can read a book in about 10 days, but this one I can only read maybe a half chapter at a time. Sometimes I'm lucky enough to read a whole chapter. But the way the criminal justice system is in America, the way you describe it, is just really, really so very, very painful. It makes you almost lose faith in America.
Kenneth, why is it so painful, this particular Grisham book, for you to read? What is it about the story?
Well, it's a real story. It's nonfiction, and the baseball player, Ron Williamson, was wrongly convicted, and he was so very mistreated. He had mental problems, and the prosecutor went after him. They trumped up charges against him, and they brought snitches out of the jails, and they just told lies. And, of course, the person who really did it was selling drugs to the police, and they covered up what he done. And then there was a Brady rule that they totally ignored. But in the end, he was exonerated, and he got out of prison. But the way anybody, absolutely anybody in America, can be trapped that way, and it's very, very terrible.
And this one, nonfiction from John Grisham.
This is his only nonfiction book. It's called The Innocent Man.
Yeah, John, are you trying to disabuse us, disillusion us, goad people to act? What here?
All the above, and first of all, I'm trying to tell a story that is extremely painful to tell. And I met Ron's family and sisters. I never heard of his story until he died, and I saw his obituary, and that's how I got onto the story. It's such a fascinating story, and it's extremely painful to research and read, because it could easily have been prevented, like many of these wrongful convictions. I mentioned I'm on the board of the Innocence Project. We now have 300 of these DNA exonerations. Multiply Ron Williamson's story by 300 and probably by several thousand, and that's what you have in this country, lives that have been ruined and wrecked by bad police work, bad prosecutors, ignorant juries, whatever. It's a long list of reasons why wrongful convictions happen, and we're trying to stop it. But I wanted that book. And by the way, I've written 30 books. That's the one book I can't get out of my system. I still wake up in the middle of the night thinking about The Innocent Man, because it's a true story. And the people who are at fault are still around and never paid a price for it. The police and the prosecutors who cook up these bogus convictions and get these prosecutions are never brought to justice. We don't have any case where they've ever been brought to justice because they control the system. And part of the reason I wrote that book was just try to illuminate some of these problems and bring attention to wrongful convictions.
What's at the very heart of the wrongful conviction problem? I mean, you've mentioned many aspects about particularities in the legal system that may lead to it, but what's at the bottom? Is it public fear that's so great that it tolerates even a kind of corruption of the justice system? Or at very bottom, what drives it?
Well, I don't think these guys set out to be corrupt. When there's a murder, a big murder, sensational murder in a small town, probably the same way in a big city, the police and homicide detectives and the prosecutors are under enormous pressure to solve the crime. And, that's the way they operate, and they can't, that's inherent in the system. And when they get off track, when they usually the first mistake happens when often at the scene of the crime, the cops will say, okay, well, I got a hunch. I think this is what happened. And that usually leads to tunnel vision. And when they get locked in on a suspect or a theory, and they start excluding anything that's contradictory, and they include everything that's possibly can mm-hmm. help them, and they go marching off the wrong direction. And before you know it, they've got the wrong suspect. They're not corrupt in that they're taking money from somebody who did the killing. That doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. And so I wouldn't use the word corrupt. I would say they're just terribly, terribly misguided and wrong in the way that they go about getting these wrongful convictions. And in the case of Ron Williamson, to show you how stupid it was, the real killer was the last person seen alive with the victim, and they were arguing outside of a nightclub, and they knew each other, and that's how he gained access to her apartment. He was the last person seen alive with the victim. And for 5 years, the police did not pursue him. They went after Ron Williamson, who had never met the victim.
The wrong guy ends up in the spotlight. We're talking with John Grisham. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Maria is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Maria. You're on the air with John Grisham.
Hi, Tom and John. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Hello, Maria.
Hi. Listen, John, you focus a lot on the criminal side of law and how corrupt it is, and wrongfully accused and that side of the court system. And I'm wondering if you have any intent on ever shifting focus to the family side of the court system and the profiteering that goes on there.
You think it's rich hunting grounds for a novelist like Grisham, Maria?
Absolutely. If he looks into terms such as parental alienation syndrome and battered women syndrome and how a crime is downplayed in the family court system as opposed to in criminal law, just to speak for an example, if somebody gets jumped and beat up on the street by a stranger, that person will see more time in jail than if a husband beats his wife, who may see just an order of protection.
Maria, let us pick it up. John, how about it? Have you looked at it? Have you done it? Would you go there?
Well, thank you, Maria. Yes, I there aren't too many issues that are not on my list of possible areas of research that might lead to a book. I'm fascinated by the law. This is what I write about, and I'm always trolling for what can be a good story. And the best books I write are the books where I can take an issue, such as the one you're talking about, Maria, and weave a novel through it, make it compelling, make the pages turn, but take the reader in a direction the reader was not really expecting to go. But that you mentioned a perfect example of something that could be, you know, a very compelling story. I would be a little bit worried about it because it could be so depressing. But oftentimes, those are the issues that need to be exposed. And I'm not overplaying my importance in society. Mm. You know, I can't change a lot of things, but these are the kinds of books I like to write.
One a year since 1988 or so. That's just an amazing amount of production. How far out are you planning the next book and the next book as you're writing the current one? Do you have the next two or three already in the back of your mind?
No, not as books, but as topics, issues, possibilities. I'm always clipping newspaper articles, magazine articles. I have a thick file that I touch almost weekly. I'll see something that looks fascinating. And then I have certain stories like I'm fascinated by Guantanamo Bay because we have inmates there, prisoners we've charged with crimes but never brought to trial in 7, 8 years, whatever. They've been, in many cases, tortured, beaten, whatever, and we still won't bring them, charge them. What do you do with them? You know, it's fascinating. I've got a big, thick file on Guantanamo Bay. I don't know if it's going to lead to a book. But, yeah, I'm always constantly looking for a good story related to the law.
And have you got it down to a production science? What, your books are 300, 350 pages. How many man-hours is that at the keyboard?
Well, the schedule I'm on now, we published in late October today for this year, and I know I'll publish next October, you know, if I stay healthy and all that. To do that, I've got to finish a good first draft, which is about 500 pages, by around July the 1st. So I'll start January the 1st and start, you know, writing every day, 5 days a week, sometimes six. And it's usually from about 7 in the morning till about 10, 11, you know, 5, 6, 7 pages a day, and that's the schedule. I'm pretty disciplined about it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the master of the legal thriller, John Grisham, about his writing life, his life, American justice, and his latest thriller, 30th book. 275 million copies of his books in print. The new one out today is The Racketeer. Lots of legal thrillers, but not only those. Elizabeth writes to us on Facebook, says, I love his other books, the non-law books, too. She says, my favorite is a painted house. My mother's family is from Black Oak, Arkansas. Feels like I've seen part of her life by reading that book. His latest, The Racketeer, begins, I am a lawyer, and I am in prison. Goes on, I'm 43 years old, halfway through a 10-year sentence, handed down by a weak and sanctimonious federal judge in Washington, D.C., nothing will help my cause. Well, turns out not to be that simple. John Grisham joins us from New York. Bruce is calling from Boston. Bruce, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was a criminal defense attorney. I practiced law for almost 20 years and found myself in the same position as the lawyer in The Racketeer. I ended up going to not a state prison or a federal prison, but a county jail for, I got a 5-year sentence. I got two and a half concurrent sentences and ended up making my way out of there in a little bit short of 2 years. But I
What was the charge, Bruce? What was the charge?
A lot of fraud and conspiracy and uttering charges. I personally practiced criminal defense law, but I had a couple people in my office that were handling personal injury, and, you know, I admittedly used client funds almost as a line of credit with the intention of paying them back and got into a hole and couldn't dig out of it. And
So in your case, it sounds like it was justice or not.
There's no question that I deserve to be there. I guess it's a completely different perspective, obviously, being on one side and then having seen it from the other side. And it's funny because a lot of inmates used to come up to me and say, you know, what's your perspective now? Not that I didn't fight as hard when I was on the street, but once being in there and seeing actually what a day is like on the inside, obviously it presents a completely different perspective, and the frustration is so much more heightened, and the ineptitude of lawyers and judges is, you know, it's you're in the trenches with these guys. So it's an eye-opening experience, and it's probably one that I would never trade for anything in my life, although never to be repeated, obviously.
Wow, 2 years in jail. John Grisham's character in The Racketeer becomes the kind of in-house attorney for a whole lot of other prisoners. Did people come to you for that, Bruce?
My door, I was probably busier in there than I was on the street, and that's where the frustration comes in, because there were a lot of guys that couldn't get a hold of their lawyers. They had cases coming up for trial. They didn't get jail credits they were supposed to get, and I found myself writing motions every day, and you know, I helped a lot of people, and, you know, the sad thing is jails are filled with drug addicts and drunks, and they continually, I mean, just the 2 years I was there, I saw the same people coming back 2, 3, sometimes 4 times, and after being released for maybe a week. And the problem is with the integration and the transgression to the streets, and it's just there's nothing for these guys that helps them transition, nothing whatsoever.
Hey, thank you, Bruce, so much for your call. John Grisham, there's an attorney who did the crime, I guess, did the time, and saw that path beaten to his door by other inmates, which is central to your new book.
Well, see, that's Bruce's story is fascinating. I mean, all aspects of it. That's where I get ideas, and when I'm writing, I do. That's where some of the research comes. Bruce could tell stories that we wouldn't believe because he's been there. And mm-hmm. Bruce, I've been out of law school for 30 years. I've probably known half a dozen lawyers who did the same thing you did. The client's money is sitting there in trust. You get in a bind with your law practice or bills or whatever. You borrow some of that money, and maybe the first couple of times you pay it back, and then you start digging a hole and you can't get out of it. It happens quite frequently, as you know, in law offices. So, but I you know, appreciate your honesty, and I, you know, again, it's fascinating. The jailhouse lawyers, the guys on the inside, stay extremely busy. And they're usually very popular inmates because they're writing motions and helping people, you know, get out of jail if they can.
Boy, you can just imagine the line at that bar door. Ivan, thank you, Bruce. Edmund, Oklahoma. Ivan's calling. Ivan, you're on with John Grisham.
Well, hello, John.
Hello, sir.
I'm an avid reader of yours, and I just want to thank you because when I'm reading your book, I just can't wait to get back to it again. I just finished reading The Appeal, and you really threw me for a loop at the end of that book because you did such a great job of this hero you talked about earlier, this small law firm, husband and wife, and they were on this appeal against this big, pretty corrupt, wiped out this town, this oil situation.
Right.
But I think this is one of the few books, and you developed these characters, I thought, really well. This young, not necessarily young, but this small private law firm. Well, they lost out in the end. The book ended with a bad guy winning, sitting on his yacht, just gloating about how he had won this thing. Would you like to comment on that?
Oh, sure, Ivan. Listen, the dirtiest letters I've received from fans all come from The Appeal, or most of them come from The Appeal because of the ending. And, you know, it was a
bad guys on top.
Bad guys win. It was a tough, harsh ending, but that is the reality of what we see nowadays in so many of these judicial elections. I mean, I think I make the point in the book that 35, 38 states elect their judges, and it's just not a good system, not a good way to select judges. And you know, that was the purpose of the book, but because the big money is taking over Supreme Courts all over the country, and they're trying to do so to directly influence future cases. And that was the whole purpose of the book. But believe me, Ivan, I hear you loud and clear on the ending because I've heard it from a lot of people.
Sandra Day O'Connor and others campaigned against that election of judges in that way. Hey, give us a little more feeling of the racketeer. There's a part here, if you could read, where he's just out of prison and he's sleeping with a gun. A sort of maybe one of his very first days, he's managed to get a car, he's managed to get out to get south. Chapter 26.
Yeah, he's our hero is in Florida, and when you go into witness protection, you really have a fair amount of leeway in where you can go. The marshals will set you up pretty much wherever you want to go. And our guy is in he's around Jacksonville, Florida, and the beaches down there. And this is the beginning of chapter 26. I sleep with a gun, a Beretta 9mm. Legally purchased by me and duly licensed by the state of Florida. I haven't fired a weapon in 20 years, since my days as a Marine, and I have no desire to start shooting now. It's resting on the cardboard box that passes as a nightstand beside my bed. Another box on the floor is filled with the possessions I need: my laptop, iPad, some books, a shaving kit, a Ziploc bag filled with cash, a couple of files with personal records, and a prepaid cell phone with unlimited minutes and a Miami area code. A cheap suitcase, one that will fit into the Audi's rather small trunk, is packed with my wardrobe and ready to go. Most of these items, the gun, the cell phone, the suitcase, were purchased recently just in case a quick exit became necessary. Well, said exit is now at hand. Before dawn, I load the car and wait. I sit on my terrace for the last time, sipping coffee and watching the ocean fade into pink, then orange, as the sun peeks over the horizon. I've watched this many times and never grow tired of it. On a clear morning, the perfect sphere rises from the water and says, "Hello, good morning, what another fine day it's going to be."
John Grisham, reading from his latest, The Racketeer. Won't be long before he's out over that water or some nearby water. I love the detail and the way you work with it. Private jet travel gets some attention from John Grisham in The Racketeer. You found an awful lot of wiggle room when it comes to private jet travel. Tell us.
Well, one of my great indulgences, I guess, in the last 10 years is to have one of those things, and you can go anywhere you want to go, whenever you want to go, and there are different rules when you land at certain airports. It's just easier to come and go. And our hero figures this out. He's got some money in his pocket, and it becomes a very important part of the plot as he gets deeper into it. I'm not going to ruin the surprise, and it'll take a long time to explain anyway, but the private jet plays a crucial role in our guy's scheme, put it that way.
It's kind of an unimaginable amount of latitude that you have once you're traveling that way compared to what most people are used to.
Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned that you've done that recently. I think people look at, you got 275 million books in print. That's just a staggering, staggering number. And I'm sure I'm not the only one who does the math and say, well, gee, if he makes, you know, $3.95 off each of those, he's a billionaire. I mean, is it like that?
No, it's not a billion. It's I don't want to talk about money, but it's nowhere close to that. But it's, you know, it's, you do a book a year, two books a year, and the books are bestsellers. And I'm lucky to have the books translated into 41 languages, I think, or 42. And in many of the bigger markets, mainly European markets in the UK, the books are very popular. And so, yeah, I mean, there's just a lot of book sales out there, which means a lot of income.
What's that meant for your life? I've been down in Mississippi, Oxford, been by your place there. Now, I was on the way to see William Faulkner's house. And of course, Roanoke, since it was tremendous to visit. But there's your big place with that long string of fence. And there's you've got another, you just is described in the PR material for you as a plantation, no less, in Virginia. How do you divide your time?
Well, it's not a plantation. It used to be. Many 200 years ago, it was a grand old plantation that got chopped up, and there's not much left now but the house, and the house is 200 years old. That's why we bought it. I don't want to own land. I'm not a farmer. I don't ride horses. I don't want to have to deal with all that stuff. But we spend almost all of our time in Virginia. We've been there for 18 years on a farm that's very secluded and way out of town, and raised our kids there. We still have the place in Oxford, and we go back whenever we can. We have family there and a lot of friends, so we kind of go back and forth.
And are you still the Little League commissioner somewhere in one of those towns?
Well, when you build your own ballpark, you can be the commissioner, and that's what I did 17 years ago when my kids were playing, and there were no ball fields in our neck of the woods, so I built this, started off as a small park and kept growing, and now it has 500 kids every year on about 40 teams. From March through August, and it's a wonderful ballpark, and, yeah, I get to be the commissioner.
We know you're a big, big baseball fan. John Grisham with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tim in Stanton, Virginia. Tim, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. This is that's a perfect segue for what I wanted to talk about. The man rather than his books. I've never read one of his books, but he is quite a philanthropist. He's been blessed with this gift of writing these fabulous stories, and like his neighbor Dave Matthews, who's also a gifted artist, they both give back tremendous amounts to the community. And he and his wife Renee both walk the talk. During the last campaign, his wife Renee went door to door with dogs biting at her heels while she was trying to register voters in poor neighborhoods and stuff. And he does more than just write checks, like he was just talking about the ballparks.
Yeah.
He just didn't pay for that park. He would be out there raking up the infield and talking with parents and interacting with people.
Kudos, big kudos. I see that we hear there from you, Tim, and John Grisham, they're straight in your ears there in New York.
Thanks, Tim. Good to hear from you.
Yeah. What is it that, I mean, when you've got all those books published, when you've made quite a good pile of money, what keeps you writing to make the extra buck? Is it to build another ballpark? What's the motivation?
I hope it's not greed. I ask myself that all the time. Here's the truth. I still love to write these books. I love to put together a wicked plot like you find in The Racketeer. Mm-hmm. And I love to entertain. There are a lot of readers out there. I'm blessed with a lot of very loyal fans who expect a book a year. And
does it keep you amused? Does it keep you engaged with life? Is that it?
Sure. And then listen, I have nothing else to do, okay? I mean, if I didn't go to my office between 7 and 10, 7 and 11 every morning, there's nothing else to fill that time. I don't have another job. I don't want another job. This is what I do. And, you only get one chance to kind of be on top of the heap, and I've been lucky, been there for a long time, but why would I quit now? I don't think it's greed. I ask myself that all the time. Are you writing all these books just because you want to make another buck? I don't think so, because at some point, you can buy anything you want to buy.
Yeah.
It's something I still enjoy doing. I think with time, nobody stays on top forever in popular culture. I don't care if it's music, movies, books, whatever. You know, it comes and goes, and then it goes away.
And it's a long time now with you.
I've been lucky.
1980s, you wonder how long. You got people at the other end of that pipeline hoping to someday get somewhere. And you hear Garrett writes to us, he says, "What advice do you have, John, for up-and-coming novelists?" Garrett writes, "I released my first book last year, trying to keep to a discipline of putting out at least one work a year to keep myself fresh, on point," we love that, "and continually learning more about my voice and technique." What's your advice to that young writer with one book out and the hope of one a year?
Well, he's lucky. I mean, I think he's got things figured out. If he's already been published, which is a dream for 99% of the people who start writing, is to actually get published, and most of them don't make it. He's on track. I mean, he's doing it. He's doing a book a year. I don't know what he's writing. I don't know, you know, what the market is. But I really have no advice for someone like him. Mm-hmm. I tell aspiring writers occasionally, and again, I don't give a lot of advice because I didn't seek advice when I was trying. I don't think writers can give advice. Mm-hmm. You have to know what you want to write about. But until you're writing at least one page a day, every day, nothing's going to happen. You've got to have that kind of discipline to outline your story and then write it at least a page a day. If you do that, you finish the book in a year or so, and you got a manuscript. And until you're doing that, nothing's going to happen as a writer.
And then you're in business. And that from a man who's done it for 30 years. John Grisham joins us. His latest thriller out today is The Racketeer. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Author of The Firm, The Pelican Brief, The Time to Kill, The Client, The Chamber, and on, John Grisham, it's been a real pleasure to speak with you. Thanks so very much for joining us today.
Tom, the pleasure is mine. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thanks a lot. John Grisham, The Racketeer is the book. You can continue the conversation at onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.